I was sitting at breakfast one morning with the feeling of having turned back the clock. My partner was refilling my coffee cup when his brother cleared his throat.
You know, there may be something in this Rain's ghost business after all. Tristan pushed his chair back from the breakfast table, stretched out his legs more comfortably, and resumed his study of the Dalaby and Holton Times. It says here that they've got a historian looking into it, and this man has unearthed some interesting facts. Siegfried didn't say anything, but his eyes narrowed as his brother took out a woodbine and lit it. Siegfried had given up smoking a week ago, and he didn't want to watch anybody light up. Particularly somebody like Tristan, who invested even the smallest action with quiet delight, rich fulfillment. My boss's mouth tightened to a grim line as the young man unhurriedly selected a cigarette, flicked his lighter, and dragged the smoke deep with a kind of ecstatic gasp. "Yes," Tristan continued, thin outgoing wisps mingling with his words. "This chap points out that several of the monks were murdered at Rain's Abbey in the 14th century. Well, so what?" snapped Siegfried. Tristan raised his eyebrows. "This cowled figure that's been seen so often lately near the abbey, why shouldn't it be the spirit of one of those monks?" "What? What's that you say? Well, after all, it makes you think, doesn't it? Who knows what fell deeds might have been?" "What the hell are you talking about?" Siegfried barked. Tristan looked hurt. "That's all very well, and you may laugh, but remember what Shakespeare said." He raised a solemn finger. "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your..." "Oh, balls!" said Siegfried, bringing the discussion effectively to a close. I took a last thankful swallow of coffee and put down my cup. I was pleased that the topic had petered out fairly peacefully, because Siegfried was in an edgy condition. After last week, he had been a dedicated puffer of pipe and cigarettes. He had also developed a classical smoker's cough, and had suffered increasingly from violent stomachache. At times, his long, thin face had assumed the appearance of a skull, the cheeks deeply sunken, the eyes smouldering far down in their sockets, and the doctor had said he must give up smoking. Siegfried had obeyed, felt immediately better, and was instantly seized with the evangelical zeal of the convert. But he didn't just advise people to give up tobacco. I've seen him several times strike a cigarette from the trembling fingers of farm workers, push his face to within inches of theirs, and grind out menacingly, "Now don't ever let me see you with one of those bloody things in your mouth again, do you hear?" Even now there are grizzled men who tell me with a shudder, "Nay, I've never had a fag since Mr. Fannin told me to stop 30 years back." "Nay, bugger it, the way he looked at me, I dursn't do it." However, the uncomfortable fact remained that his crusade hadn't the slightest effect upon his brother. Tristan smoked almost continuously, and he never coughed, and his digestion was excellent. Siegfried looked at him now as he contentedly tapped off a little ash and took another blissful suck. "You smoke too many of those bloody cigarettes. So do you." "No, I don't," Siegfried retorted. "I am a non-smoker, and it's time you were too. It's a filthy habit, and you'll kill yourself the way you're going." Tristan gave him a benign look, and again his words were floating out on the fine woodbine mist. "Oh, I'm sure you're wrong. Do you know, I think it rather agrees with me." Siegfried got up and left the room. I sympathised with him, for he was in a difficult position. Being in loco parentis, he was, in a sense, providing his brother with the noxious weeds, and his innate sense of propriety prevented him from abusing this position by dashing the things from Tristan's hands, as he did with others. He had to fall back on exhortation, and it was getting him nowhere. And there was another thing. He probably wanted to avoid a row this morning, as Tristan was leaving on one of his mysterious trips back to the veterinary college. In fact, my first job was to take him down to the Great North Road, where he was going to hitch a lift. After I'd left him there, I set off on my rounds, and as I drove, my thoughts kept going back to the conversation at breakfast. A fair number of people were prepared to swear that they'd seen the Rain's ghost, and though it was easy to dismiss some of them as sensation-mongers or drunkards, the fact remained that others were very solid citizens indeed. And the story was always the same. There was a hill beyond Rain's village, and at the top a wood came right up to the roadside. Beyond lay the abbey. People driving up the hill late at night said they had seen the monk in their headlights, a monk in a brown habit just disappearing into the wood. They believed the figure had been walking across the road, but they weren't sure because it was always a little too far away. But they were adamant about the other part. They had seen a cowled figure, head bowed, go into that wood. There must have been something uninviting about the apparition, because nobody ever said that they'd gone into the wood after it. It was strange that after my thoughts had been on rains during the day, I should be called to the village at 1 o'clock the following morning. Crawling from bed and climbing wearily into my clothes, I couldn't help thinking of Tristan, curled up peacefully in his Edinburgh lodgings, far away from the troubles of practice. But I didn't feel too bad about getting up. Rains was only 3 miles away, and the job held no prospect of hard labour. A colic and a little boy's Shetland pony. And it was a fine night, very cold with the first chill of autumn, but with a glorious full moon to light my way along the road. They were walking the pony round the yard when I got there. The owner was the accountant at my bank, and he gave me a rueful smile. "I'm very sorry to get you out of bed, Mr. Herrier, but I was hoping this bit of bellyache would go off. We've been parading him around here for 2 hours. When we stop, he tries to roll." "No, you've done the right thing," I said. "Rolling can cause a twist in the bowel." I examined the little animal and was reassured. He had a normal temperature, good strong pulse, and listening at his flank, I could hear the typical abdominal sounds of spasmodic colic. What he needed was a good evacuation of the bowel. But I had to think carefully when computing the dose of arecoline for this minute member of the equine species. I finally settled on 1/8 of a grain and injected into the neck muscles. The pony stood for a few moments in the typical colic position, knuckling over and sinking down on one hind leg, then the other, and occasionally trying to lie down. "Walk him on again slowly, will you?" I was watching for the next stage, and I didn't have long to wait. The pony's jaws began to champ and his lips to slobber, and soon long dribbles of saliva hung down from his mouth. All right so far, but I had to wait another 15 minutes before he finally cocked his tail and deposited a heap of feces on the concrete of the yard. "Ah, I think he'll be okay now," I said. "So I'll leave you to it. Give me another ring if he's still in pain." Beyond the village, the road curved suddenly out of sight of the houses, then began the long straight climb to the abbey. Just up there, at the limits of my headlights, would be where the ghost was always seen, walking across the road and into the black belt of trees. At the top of the hill, on an impulse, I drew into the side of the road and got out of the car. This was the very place. At the edge of the wood, under the brilliant moon, the smooth boles of the beeches shone with an eerie radiance, and high above, the branches creaked as they swayed in the wind. I walked into the wood, feeling my way carefully with an arm held before me, until I came out the other side. Rains Abbey lay before me. I had always associated the beautiful ruin with summer days, with the sun warming the old stones of the graceful arches, the chatter of voices, children playing on the cropped turf, but this was 2:30 a.m. in an empty world, and the cold breath of the coming winter on my face. I felt suddenly alone. In the cold glare, everything was uncannily distinct. But there was a look of unreality about the silent rows of columns reaching into the dark sky and throwing their long, pale shadows over the grass. Away at the far end, I could see the monks' cells, gloomy, black cabins deep in shadow. And as I looked, an owl hooted, accentuating the heavy, blanketing silence. A prickling apprehension began to creep over me. A feeling that my living person had no place here among these brooding relics of dead centuries. I turned quickly and began to hurry through the wood, bumping into trees, tripping over roots and bushes, and when I reached my car, I was trembling and more out of breath than I should have been. It was good to slam the door, turn the ignition, and hear the familiar roar of the engine.